May it please the Court, I'm Frederick Berry from Phoenix, Arizona. I represent the appellant plaintiff, Vicente Prieto. From my perspective, I think there's two broad issues here. First of all is whether District Court Judge Strand erred in granting summary judgment in favor of the insurance company on the issues of bad faith and punitive damages. And secondly, after Judge Strand went on senior status and transferred the case to Judge Murguia, whether she made a mistake at trial in concluding that Dr. Prieto waived his right to receive 1 year of insurance benefits and she did this sua sponte.
This was a bench trial.
Yes, Your Honor. It originally was going to be a jury trial. After the plaintiff lost bad faith and punitive damages, we stipulated to a bench trial at that point in time with Judge Strand, and the case was transferred to Judge Murguia. I think the first issue is resolved by analysis of what I consider to be the dispositive case in Arizona, which is the Zilich versus State Farm case. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Arizona very clearly set forth the fact that this fair debatability doctrine that the insurance industry has been advancing over the years is in most situations a jury question. And although under certain circumstances a trial court judge can consider summary judgment in the absence of any evidence, I think the record here is full of very persuasive evidence from the records, the testimony, and particularly the affidavits of a bad faith expert, John O'Connell, who's very well respected, has a PhD in insurance and teaches insurance, is a CPCU. And he said that Paul Revere was guilty of bad faith in various particulars, one of which was never even addressed by Judge Strand, and that is the low ball offer. We have an insurance claim that's worth about $850,000. Paul Revere came in at a time when they knew Dr. Prieto was in a cash crunch, at a time when it knew that he was desperately trying to go back to work, and offered him $25,000, not just to buy out the claim and sell the claim, but to buy out the entire policy. Here's an insured that has a diabetic wound on a policy he bought back in the early 80s. You don't have to be an actuary to understand that a person like this does not have a good prospect for recovery. But they offered him $25,000 right then and there on the spot to buy out his claim.
I have a hard time believing that an offer of money that one could take or leave could be proof of bad faith. You don't like the offer? Say no, I don't like the offer. Give me $800,000. Give me $250,000. You know, they offer you low, you respond with high, and that's how people trade bargains.
Well, in an ordinary commercial,
I don't know how sort of this this shows bad faith.
In an ordinary commercial transaction, Judge, you're right. People dicker back and forth all the time, and that's business, no problem. But this is an insurance transaction where there's unequal bargaining power, and the commentators
What's unequal about it?
Well, you have an insurance company worth billions and billions of dollars, and an insured who has bought this safety net, he thinks, who is really down.
It happens all the time. I mean, you know, we're constantly dealing with companies much larger than ourselves.
True, it does happen all the time.
The point when it comes to this claim is it has an economic value, and he can just say no.
The Supreme Court of Arizona.
Put food on the table, and they have the mortgage, they want to kick him on the street. Say, no, go get out of here. It's not enough money.
Well, Judge,
I just don't see it.
The Supreme Court of Arizona disagrees, and in the Zilich versus State Farm case, which is stare decisis in this case, Judge Martone says that lowballing is bad faith. That's the law of Arizona. And this is lowballing, according to Dr. O'Connell. And I think it's lowballing to anybody that looks at it. A claim that's worth $850,000, offering $25,000, it's lowballing by any perspective.
I think without going back and checking, I believe I'm willing to bet that what you find is that was lowballing payment of a settlement of the claim, not lowballing and buying out the policy.
Well, Your Honor,
those are very different things. If a company is on the hook for a claim and then they lowball the amount they're willing to pay a legal obligation, that's quite different from saying, look, we have a contract. We're willing to buy out this contract for you. That's not. They don't have any obligation to buy the contract at all.
No, but the
company find it economically feasible to do it, but this is not a situation where they had a legal obligation to buy out the contract.
That's true.
Justice Martin was talking about, lowballing, situation where the insurance company has a obligation to pay the claim and they lowball. They lowball on their obligation. But where's the obligation to buy out the contract?
There is no obligation to buy out the contract, Your Honor, but under the circumstances, buying out the contract also buys out the claim.
Would it certainly have been great for the insurance company to be able to do it?
Right.
But this was not a situation where they had an obligation to pay and they say, oh, we know we have to pay X, we're going to lowball you just to force into court. This was a separate transaction. This was saying, look, we know we're going to have some liability here, we'll just buy you out. You want to talk about something else? I mean, I'm not finding this very helpful.
Well, I do think that, I have to respectfully disagree with the court that this is a clear
case. But that's what Bartoni was talking about, wasn't it? He was talking about lowballing and a claim.
Yes, the Zillich case was a claim. Sorry. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I didn't even have to read the opinions to know that.
But I'll tell you, Judge, as a matter of fact, the offer that was made in this case was to buy out the contract, which included the claim. And the
in which case?
Our case, Prieto versus Paul Revere. It's admitted in the answering brief.
Well, all right, but at that point there was a current obligation to they had just paid him what, 2 months or 3 months of benefits?
Well, they promised him 3 months but paid him 2 months. So they did pay him some money.
Right. And at that point he had no pending claim.
Well, he had told them that he was hoping to go back to work, and he expected, projecting into the future, that he'd be able to return to work in a few months, and that was what was discussed in his home.
But there was no pending claim. He was not at that point saying, okay, you've paid me for 2 months or 3 months, and I'm making claim for the future. After he'd gotten that money, there was no claim pending. So it's not like they're... It's not like there is some claim they're lowballing him on.
The claim, excuse me, that Dr. Prieto made at that time, he expected only to be out of work for a few months. I think he expected to be out of work for a total of 5 months. There was a waiting period. But unfortunately, his rosy expectation of when he was going to be able to go back to work did not turn out, as was developed during testimony at trial. Dr. So testified that he was continuously disabled for the entire period of time and permanently disabled. So his optimism, if he would walk in this courtroom today, he would come in and tell the court that he wants to go back to work and practice chiropractic. He's a very, very hardworking guy, and he's not doing this because he's made a choice to retire. He's making a claim because of the promises contained in this insurance contract. And Dr.
Can I clarify something? I want to make sure that you're not appealing the finding of no total disability. The payments are partial disability, I understand it, or residual.
Well, the trial court judge found that there was a total disability for a while, then there was a partial disability for a while, and then there was a total disability.
Right.
And that's not being appealed. We're only appealing, Your Honor, the issue of the summary judgment on bad faith and punitive damages.
And the waiver.
And the waiver issue.
Okay.
There's evidence in the record. Dr. O'Connell's affidavit goes on and on and on, pointing out specific issues where he believes that the insurance company acted in bad faith. Judge Strand addressed some of them, didn't address others. Roy Gill, who was the former chief examiner of the Arizona Insurance Department, testified by way of affidavit regarding the motivation why Paul Revere would want to engage in bad faith claim handling. motivation is always relevant. Whether you're running a red light on the way to the airport or doesn't make any difference. Paul Revere's lost $1.3 billion in writing these very liberal insurance contracts. It had, in the year this claim was denied, 139% combined loss ratio, which
I noticed you submitted some cases regarding Paul Revere's litigation. I only saw one where there was a finding of bad faith for the period after 1999, but I was wondering what that has to do with this case and how one could consider the evidence in that case in this case.
Pattern and practice, Your Honor, which is relevant in...
But don't you have to introduce that in this case? In the record before we get it?
Well, we did have some evidence of pattern and practice through the testimony of a former Provident employee, Dr. Feist. And these were just additional illustrations of Paul Revere and his sister companies adopting a practice of turning down valid claims. It's epidemic throughout the country.
It wasn't before the district court at that time, so it wasn't part of this record. So
no, that's correct.
I'm just was having a hard time to know what I was supposed to do with those cases.
Well, it was not before. You're right, Your Honor. Those cases were not before the district court below when it made its determination. That is correct.
So answer Judge Rosani's question. So what do we do with them?
Well,
if they're not in the record, what do we treat? How do we deal with them? What good does they do? Do they do you?
Well, I think that it may assist the court in seeing the trend and the pattern and practice that Paul Revere and his sister companies are engaged in simply not paying valid claims. Whether you make any use of that or not is up to you.
Well, if I wanted to make a use of it, what a use of it could I make of it?
I'm thinking as I look at the clock.
You've got 7 minutes and 54 seconds.
I see that, Judge. Thank you.
Would you like to sort of save that for rebuttal?
Well, I'll think about that a little bit further. Maybe I can save that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay.
Let me address the issue of waiver. I talked about that in the briefs, but I want to bring up a new point that I thought of this morning. You know, waiver is an equitable remedy. And as an equitable remedy, it's invoked sometimes to favor an insured in an insurance transaction. Given the fact that insurance is vested with the public interest, that there is typically an unequal bargaining power between insureds and insurers, the doctrine of waiver, being an equitable remedy, is never used by the court to allow an insurance company to avoid a contractual undertaking. For that, insurance companies have to look at the insurance contract and see what provisions in the insurance contract, or in some cases, statutory provisions, allow the insurance company to defend a claim.
Well, I was a little confused on this waiver claim. Did he miss some deadline, contractual deadline, with regard to this period?
No, he didn't.
Okay.
He waited for nearly, wasn't really a year, well, it was about a year, roughly, to go back to the insurance company and ask for more insurance benefits. During that year period, he had opened up his office, he had moved his office, because he thought his client base, having been in South Phoenix, had moved north, because he served the Hispanic community in Phoenix. He moved his office north, trying to catch up with his client base. This was his rationale. He did some advertising. He put out some flyers. But nothing like this worked. The reality, of course, is that Dr. Prieto had amputated, a great portion of his foot had been amputated. It was twice the size, and that's in the record, twice the size of a normal foot because of a skin graft and muscle graft performed by Dr. So. His foot stunk. It was a festering, non-healing wound. He was on crutches or in a wheelchair, sometimes on a cane. And guess what? His patients left him, and he couldn't make a go of it. Some days he would have 4 patients. Some days he would have 2. At the time his deposition was taken, he had 1 patient. But yet he still tried to make a success of his chiropractic practice. He was entitled to benefits. So finally, after about a year, he went back to the insurance company and said, I want to make further claim under my policy. And Paul Revere said, no, we're not going to pay you benefits, not because you're not disabled, because you probably are disabled, but because your chiropractic practice is in decline. And for that, which is, of course, not nowhere found in the insurance contract, and for that, Paul Revere puts together some selected statistics.
But it is really part of it, because if his loss is from a decline not connected to his foot, they don't have to pay, right? So that's what they're saying. This decline doesn't have to do with your foot.
Well, that's what they said.
In that sense, it is part of the insurance agreement. They didn't contract to pay for any old decline in business. They contracted to pay something that's related to his disability. So that's what they're saying, isn't it? It's not related to your disability.
But it's factually 100% wrong.
That's a different argument.
But it goes back to summary judgment. You know, they drew a graph that made his practice decline like that by selecting months here and months there. When reality sets in, you draw a graph that we put in that his practice was only in de minimis decline. So Paul Revere lied to their insured and said, we're not going to pay your benefits because your practice is in decline. Lying to an insured is bad faith in any court. And certainly it should be the law of Arizona and is the law of Arizona. You know,
You say lie, but maybe that's how they saw it. I mean, they look at the people coming in through the door, they count them, and they say, look, your business is declining. How are they to know whether that's because his foot smells or because he changed offices because his patients move? You know, that can lead to a decline in practice having nothing to do with disability. Maybe by the time he moved, it was too late. Maybe they got doctor at the new location that they liked better.
They didn't do an investigation adequate to determine, which is a touchstone of bad faith in Arizona. That's the law of Arizona.
Can I ask what happened with what appears to be his lie, that he didn't go back to work till May, when in fact he went back to work in March?
They agreed, Your Honor, they being Dr. Prieto and the insurance adjuster, that he could attempt to go back to work earlier, and they would pay him benefits anyway. These insurance companies want their claimants to go back to work to try to reestablish their
claim. So they didn't pursue that because it was basically part of an understanding.
I mean, talk about waiver. That's a good example of where waiver does work when an insurance company waives a condition. And they clearly waive that. That's never been debated or argued or anything like that.
Is that clarification?
Yeah. The bottom line here is that Paul Revere acted in bad faith. It denied a clearly covered claim, and they did so for monetary gain. They wanted to keep the money for themselves that they had promised to pay Dr. Prieto.
You got 2 minutes. You want to save any of this for a bottle? Or?
Yes, Your Honor. Thanks.
Would it be all right to just start with waiver? Because I thought that's a more limited issue. I didn't get this. You didn't raise waiver as a defense. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and for the record, I'm Scott Bales for Paul Revere Life Insurance Company. No, thank you. With regard to waiver, that was an issue that was raised by the court, and as we've acknowledged in our answering brief, we think the court did that appropriately under Rule 15 and the Rules of Civil Procedure. We did not allege that as an affirmative defense.
So she did that when the trial was over?
Yes.
Okay. So at no time during the trial your opponent given notice the waiver was being litigated?
Well, it was argued, and it was argued in the sense that there was evidence elicited from Dr. Prieto, and this is in the brief.
Well, he discussed that year where he didn't go back to the company.
Correct. His statements, and this was first in an affidavit submitted in the summary judgment briefing, which is at supplemental excerpts of record page 40. His statement was that he understood in April of 96 when he talked to the insurance adjuster that if he had a continuing problem, he should contact the company. His trial testimony was that he recognized that, yet he decided not to contact them because, in his words, he said, and this is in supplemental excerpts of record at 68 and 69, I never wanted to involve them. In my mind, I didn't want to use them.
Well,
so that
okay.
evidence.
He's saying that. But how does that put him on notice that now there's an issue as to whether for all time, not for that particular period, but for all time, he is waived, that you're arguing that he's waived that claim?
That wasn't the argument or the court's finding. She ruled that he had only waived his claim for benefits for the period from.
Exactly. And what I'm saying is, how does that put him on notice that for all time, you're arguing for all time, he has waived his benefits for that period? That his testimony in that way, how does that provide him notice that that's the big issue now?
Well, he certainly knew in the trial that the company's position was he wasn't entitled to benefits for that
right.
period.
Right, but you had told him you already said that you're not saying that there's a failure to notify the company claim under some time limit. Okay, so where's the notice?
Right.
I'm not finding that notice. Is there anything else?
Well, I think if you're asking was he given notice?
So he can fairly defend the claim of waiver.
Well, he certainly knew that the company's position, and this was argued in the case, that he was not entitled to benefits for that period because substantively he didn't qualify under the policy.
Okay, but that's fine. He knows you're arguing that he's not entitled for that period because he substantively doesn't qualify.
Correct.
But how does he know that you're arguing or that he's supposed to defend against a claim that he never that he cannot make a claim for that period because he's waived it?
Because he knowingly and intentionally forego the benefits, which is what the trial court found in her conclusions of law.
But isn't that a little bit contrary to his comment after the fact that he didn't apply for that year was gone into by the company's lawyer on cross or redirect? His Prieto's lawyer asked him why he waited for that period of time, and his response was, "I was just following the instructions of Tom Jolicoeur." Now that's quite contrary to a finding of waiver. He's saying the company representative told me some stuff, and by not filing anything in that year or going back to the company in that year, I was simply doing what the guy said.
Well, I think that would be a factual issue for the determination of the district court. And she had evidence, and this was also argued by counsel, but she had evidence based on Dr. Prieto's testimony that he said that he understood that he could go back if he had any problems after the anticipated 5 months. And it was his trial testimony where he said what I quoted earlier, that he did not want to involve them. So to the extent Dr. Prieto was inconsistent in his own testimony at trial, I think that was an issue that the district court properly could resolve.
You do agree that it is a little bit strange to I understand adding a theory in the middle of the trial, but after all the testimony is done and proofs are closed, to say, oh, by the way, you have also tried waiver, is a little bit strange because even if you let somebody know in the middle of the trial, they say, oh, well, if I knew that waiver was at issue, the other things I would have said that would have had a bearing on it, or I would have maybe presented another witness on this to show, you know, certainly what he said permitted an inference of waiver, but he certainly never said, and I intentionally and knowingly waived making this claim against the company because I, you know, didn't want the money even though I could have gotten it. He's never said anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the most he said was, I was told I could go back to them if I had more problems, and I'm an independent kind of guy, I didn't.
But
and one could certainly infer a waiver from that, but it's not the only – it's certainly not unequivocal. And I can certainly imagine that one could – that he could have continued that train of thought if he'd known waiver was the issue and said, but of course, I assume that if I waited, I wouldn't lose any rights. I was hoping to make it on my own, but I certainly had no intention at all of giving up any rights I had against the company by doing that. If he said that, that would look a lot less like waiver, wouldn't it?
Well, 2 points. First, I don't think the evidence on the waiver issue would have been any different had that been affirmatively alleged in the pleadings.
Well, I know that's your hope, but that's your...
Well, the question was...
But as you know from having been a lawyer many years, this, lawyers on the other side often surprise you with what they can come up with. You know, you sort of sit there saying, gee, they'll never come up with anything, and bam, you get to trial, and you find out they did come up with something, something you didn't expect. So we don't really know what... I mean, the fact that your best hope is that they would have come up with nothing else gives me very little comfort.
Well, the question was whether he knowingly and intentionally declined to seek the benefits. And,
right.
And that had been...
Whether he knowingly and intentionally gave up rights permanently that he knew he had. That's really the issue.
Correct.
Then by saying, I am not going to go in now because I'm hoping to make it on my own, did he know that that money will never come back to him, even if it turns out he didn't make it on his own?
Well,
that by just sort of waiting, he wouldn't be able to go back and say, oh, well, I tried on my own, but now I want the money I was owed. That's really the issue. And he certainly says nothing like that. He certainly says nothing like that.
But what he did testify to, and this was both in his trial testimony.
You're agreeing with me.
He didn't.
I am right when I say he said nothing like that.
Correct. But what he did say, and this is what supports the district court's conclusion of law, what he did say is that he understood that if he wanted benefits because he thought he was disabled beyond the expected 5 months, he should go back to Paul Revere. And when he was asked in his cross-examination, why did you not do that, his testimony was that he did not want to involve them.
What if now, realizing that the issue of waiver was on the table, counsel on redirect had said, and by doing that, did you understand and did you know and did you mean to give up these benefits forever? And he said, oh, no, I was... simply thought I was delaying things in case things got much better for me. But of course I thought that if things got worse, I would be able to go back and get my benefits. I certainly didn't mean to make a gift to the insurance company. What if that had been his answer on the redirect, which is very likely what his answer would have been if counsel had asked that question?
Well, again, I think...
You think what? I mean, isn't that the problem with trial by ambush, by having a district court come along after all the proofs are in and invent a theory and say, oh, now we have all the evidence, and based on what we have, I'm now going to make a finding on a theory that neither side was aware of that they were trying?
Well, on the other hand, I think what Rule 15 contemplates is that...
When you say on the other hand, that means, yes, you agree with me, but on the other hand...
Well, maybe I chose the wrong phrase.
Well, why don't you address the question I had? Isn't that the problem with it? If the shoe were on the other foot, and if the district court had found that Paul Revere had waived an objection of based upon these conversations, and it cost Paul Revere thousands of dollars because of this waiver that you never had a chance to know you were trying, you'd be out here yelling bloody murder, wouldn't you?
Well, let me...
Yeah, it would. It would, wouldn't you?
No, I think what Rule 15 contemplates...
You take it like a man?
Pardon me?
You take it like a man? You wouldn't let you say, oh, well, yeah, we have it coming?
I think what this boils down to, what the whole questioning boils down to, is did the district judge err under Rule 15 by treating this as something that was implicitly addressed by the parties? Because Rule 15 says, regardless of what the pleadings say, if an issue is tried by the express or implied consent of the parties, you conform your rulings to that. You treat the issue as if it had been raised in the pleadings. And that's what we argued happened here. And I think our debate is, could the district judge properly treat this as an issue that had been...
Well, I guess when I read a part of this case, when I had read the concept of implied consent, express consent, of course, you know what it means, is that the parties were actually aware of it, and although they didn't come out and say, oh, we're now trying waiver, it's obvious they're trying waiver, because they're asking questions about waiver. They're saying, you know, did you waive? Did you do this? There's no evidence of that here. The evidence that, that the plaintiff testified, he didn't go back to the insurance company. You know, he was asked, why didn't you go back and make these, you know, claims when you were told? He said, I didn't do it because I, an independent kind of guy, I was hoping to make it on my own.
Eventually, he did go back and make a claim, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So that kind of cuts against the fact that he wanted to waive these from all time. He needed to make the claim.
Well,
I mean, he got to a trial because he made a claim and it was denied, right?
I think you...
Well, is that true?
Well, I disagree that it cuts against the fact that he...
Okay. Well, we'll just deal with the fact then. He did finally make the claim, and it was denied, and that's why you had a trial. You can't even agree to that, huh?
Well, I think the chronology has been a little confused in the discussion. It's important to keep it clear. In the spring of 1996, in April, after his first surgery, after he had his toe amputated, he met with the insurance investigator, said that he thought his disability was going to last 5 months, and that's when he understood that if it did continue, he should go back to Paul Revere. Now, 15 months later, in August of 1997, he again contacted the company. And at that point, they said, send in a written letter. He did so. He sent a letter in September, and he said, one, he said he continued working, and he said he would like to be considered for total or partial disability. Now, the question of whether his failure to ask for benefits for that interim period, whether that constituted waiver as a legal matter, I don't think depends on whether someone said to him at trial, did you intend to waive? I think the judge was acting appropriately when she concluded the parties had, by implied consent, tried that issue.
I don't think anybody's saying that he had to use the magic word, but it's important for the lawyer who's trying the case to be aware of the legal theory being tried, understand what are the key elements of the legal theory, and ask questions. I mean, I'm sort of giving the shortcut, saying, oh, did you waive? But there are all sorts of things counsel can ask if he's aware that we're trying waiver that would help buttress the claim of waiver in your case and help undermine the claim of waiver in another case. And if neither side is aware of this and the district court, you know, then afterwards says, oh, well, you know, guess what, guys, we just tried waiver. Surprise, surprise. Somebody's going to be surprised, in fact. And that's what it sounds like to me. There's nothing about this transcript that suggests that lawyer on either side was aware that that was the issue being tried. And I'm not sure how you can have implicit consent, much less explicit consent, to try an issue that neither side is aware is being tried.
Well, it is true.
Did you know?
No.
Were you aware?
The arguments.
Were you aware?
Company, you were trial counsel? I wasn't trial counsel, and what I was about to say
is, did you know your time waiver?
The company's argument was that it was for a different reason.
There we go.
But the
when he finally when he did ask the company for money,
Yes.
Did he ask for money for that one-year period, August to August? That was part of his claim against the company?
When he came back in 1997, he said he wanted to be considered for partial or total disability. And he ultimately, as his claim was evaluated, was arguing that he had been totally disabled from February 1996, the time of his first amputation. Now, the company's position was, well,
but that his claim then, when he says I've been totally disabled since February of 96 forward, included this August to August year that the waiver.
Yes, sir, yes.
So the company at that time knew that he was had not, at least when he told the company that in 98 or whenever that was, that he didn't then think he had already waived it.
Well, and you're right. And the company's response in reviewing that claim was not that he had waived it. And this is in the letter that's at pages 61 and 62 of the supplemental excerpts. But in June of 98, when the company advised him that it didn't believe he was covered, it said, you're not totally disabled because you've continued working. And indeed, he continued working from the time he went back to work in March of 96 into 1999. So he was not totally disabled for that reason. The reason the company said he was not entitled to residual disability was its belief that his practice had been declining for reasons independent of his medical condition.
Okay. Now, the other question I have, as long as we're staying on waiver, is, I think, as I remember, the law school definition of waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. It's shorthand for waiver. What's the burden of proof on the party asserting waiver as a defense in a case like this, particularly where it would be the insurance company asserting waiver against the insurer? Is it just a plain old burden, or is there a little higher burden as an equitable defense in that situation?
I believe it's a preponderance, Your Honor. I have not seen any law that suggests that apart from the general burden for waiver, it would be different in this context. But I have to admit that's not an issue that we addressed in the briefs.
Okay.
In the 54 minutes, seconds left to you, the district court got the law wrong on the Zilich came down and the bad faith. I mean, it just blew it for reasons understandable enough. The law was not yet established, but shortly after the district court ruled, the Arizona Supreme Court came down with a big opinion, which looks to me like it says this is the kind of thing had better go to a jury. Right?
No. And can I, if there are 3 points, I think I can address that question.
Okay, go ahead.
First, the district court here recognized that the mere fact that a claim is fairly debatable is not dispositive of a bad faith claim. Because if an insurer, apart from that, acted unreasonably in the investigation or handling or processing of a claim and recognized that it was doing so, that also would be a basis for bad faith.
What investigation did Paul Revere do on this claim?
Well, if you, and again, the district court's order describes this at pages 168 and 169 of the excerpts of record, but promptly after Dr. Prieto made his second claim in 1997, they sent an investigator out, they requested the medical records, they requested his business records, and they then evaluated that information and they responded to Dr. Prieto the following spring.
And said no.
Yes. But there wasn't evidence.
The guy's got documented diabetes. He's had his foot cut off. In the middle of the trial, he gets another amputation. He's deteriorating. He can hardly walk. And the company says, well, you're using customers because what? People's backs have gotten better all of a sudden? There's been a sort of rash of improved pasture in Arizona?
No, Your Honor, and it was actually Dr. Prado himself who had given the company the information about the decline in his business. And this was shown not only in the field investigation in 1997, but in the April 1997.
The guy's falling apart. He's in a business that involves sitting there getting close to people, manipulating their bodies, and he himself is physically falling apart, literally. That's cutting away chunks of his body. And he's got gangrene or whatever it smells. And of course he's not going to get, he's going to lose patients.
The investigation, and this is in the letter that's it.
I don't think a jury would have liked that. I think the reason you didn't want to go to the jury is that you think the jury would have slammed you hard, your client. This is the kind of case you don't want to take to the jury, huh? I mean, if you'd been so proud of the way it was handled, you would have been happy to go to a jury.
I'm not sure. Are you asking?
No, I'm saying you asked not to go to a jury. You said this should be this way, you know, not.
Well, once the summary judgment ruling was made, as Mr. Berry stated, the parties stipulated to a bench trial. Now, as far as Zilich, for my first point was the district
court. But if the district court erred on that, there'd be a jury trial on that, wouldn't it?
You know, I can't speak to what would have happened had the motion been denied. I understand, Mr. Berry.
No, I'm talking about reversing.
Oh, yes.
This would go to a jury.
Well, procedurally, if you reversed and it went back down, I think, well, I don't know. I don't know where procedurally that would leave us, given the prior trial and...
You'd want a jury, I'm sure.
What were you trying to say about Zilich?
I'm sorry. There were the other two. The three points were that, first, Judge Strand's ruling, because he did recognize that fair debatability is not dispositive, it's consistent with Zilich. Second, after Zilich came down, the plaintiff asked Judge Strand to reconsider in light of Zilich, and that was denied. There's a order by the court in July of 2000 denying the request for reconsideration. So it's not as if the district court was oblivious to Zilich. And then finally, you know, in a way, that's an academic point, because obviously you need to assess de novo whether summary judgment was appropriate on the record before the district court at the time the motion was considered.
Applying Zilich, though.
Yeah, and Zilich itself is not a bar to summary judgment in bad faith claims. What Zilich says, and this is consistent with what the district court did in this case, is, look, is there, for purposes of bad faith, evidence that the insurer acted unreasonably in its investigation or processing of a claim, and that the insurer knew or was conscious of the fact that its acts were unreasonable? And I think if you look at Judge Strand's order, which is at 168 and 169, pertinent parts of it are at those pages, you'll see that he applied that analysis. So for the reasons we've explained, we'd urge you to affirm the district court.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just clarify, the evidence of bad faith, other than that $25,000, is the testimony of the witness about Paul Revere's practice of trying to deny all claims possible, and the, what you say was phonied up evidence of the decline in the business.
The evidence of bad faith, according to Dr. O'Connell, was that Paul Revere said it would only pay 3 months of benefits, said it would pay 3 months of benefits when it only paid two. It fixed that the day after Dr. O'Connell's opinions were disclosed. Further evidence of bad faith is Paul Revere told the plaintiff
that the claim was settled in full when it was not settled in full, that the insured had further contract benefits after that time. Dr. O'Connell also said that it was bad faith for Paul Revere not to explain recurrent and concurrent claim benefits in the insurance contract. He also said it was bad faith, as you pointed out, Judge, that the business was in decline, which was just completely false. He also said it was bad faith to tell the insured that his eligibility for receiving benefits was contingent upon him being able to return to work. The reality is that the insurance contract allows for him to file a partial disability claim or residual disability claim. Mr. Jolicure, in his report, which is a contemporaneous note, says that he told Dr. Prieto that he can file further claim if his infection prevented him from going back to work. And Dr. Prieto testified that that's why he didn't file further claim. Now, Dr. Prieto also testified, as counsel has said, that he didn't file further claim because he was hoping to get better. I mean, wishful thinking. People are really, most people truly are motivated to go back to work, in my belief. He also said it was bad faith to lowball. And this case has so many parallels to the facts in Zilich that I find it very interesting. Judge Martone, who wrote the opinion, is now on the federal bench in Phoenix. I hope that enhances his credibility. I don't know if it does or not, but he wrote that opinion, and he said that lowballing is bad faith. And there was lowballing in that case. There was lowballing in this case. Lowballing is unethical. It's indefensible. It should have never happened. The reason insurance companies lowball and the reason it's considered unethical and bad faith claims handling is because the insurance company is hoping to take a desperate person and settle a claim for peanuts. And that's what Paul Revere was trying to do here, because it lost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars selling these extremely liberal contracts. And now it has to pay the piper.
Okay, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case aside, we'll stand submitted. Messages, this is lunchtime, and counselor here in Pasadena, where we have many fine restaurants. This may be a good time for counsel to get together and talk settlement. You've heard our questions. You sort of know more about the case than you did this morning. And I think this is the kind of case where everybody might be better off if you manage to work out an amicable settlement. May I recommend the Parkway Grill, one of many nice restaurants in Pasadena. But anywhere, Lucky Boys, you know, outside dining. If you all, after this conversation, decide that you would like to have more time, we will defer submission. Just send us a letter, tell us you're engaged in serious negotiations, and we can defer submission.
I might ask them if they were contacted by the mediation unit.
Were you ever contacted by the mediation unit?
Yes, Your Honor. We were contacted by the mediation unit and conferred with it.
Uh-huh. But you didn't – did you have an actual mediation or did you
– No, we never had a mediation.
Uh-huh. Well, you now know more than you did when you walked in. And I hope that if counsel were not only talking but also listening, they realize that there's – lots of latitude. The case could go any which way and could last for many more years.
I might say that I've been told by some really, really good lawyers that our mediators are the best they have ever encountered. And I've seen them settle some cases that you wouldn't believe us if we told you. So if you think there's any opening at all, you can always go back to the mediation unit.
You know what? I will defer submission until Monday. And if I hear by close of business Monday that you have either entered negotiations or you've contacted the mediator, just the mediator will let us know. I will then continue deferring submission. I just strongly urge you to do that. I think there's significant exposure on both sides. And you've heard our questions. You should, if you're realistic about your position, you will know that nobody came out a clear winner here. So,
Your Honor, may I ask the court to defer submission to the following Monday? I do not return to the office until Tuesday.
Following Monday it is. Okay? But I still recommend lunch here. It's really quite good.
Okay, Your Honor. Okay.